Lend Me Your Ears, the Oral Dramaturgies Podcast. The Gallery, interviews with artists.
Hello, and welcome to The Gallery. Our guests today are Kate Cox and Rachel Fullagar, two of the four founder members of Leeds-based Graceful Collective. Having met at the Norden School of Contemporary Dance, at a time when the institution was beginning to leave behind the rigors of technical training in favor of creative experimentation, the four female dancers united in a shared quest for finding their voice. The conversation we're about to hear gives us a glimpse into how they make what they describe as post-intellectual, pseudo-spiritual, feminist comedy dance for the modern-day era. We hear about the company's relationship to the possibilities and limitations of dance as a medium and about the conscious choice to use speech, humor, and direct address as part of their choreography. At the center of Graceful's work, however, is the politics of collaboration and the commitment to sustaining a shared practice that is truly pluralistic and democratic. Graceful Collective is one of the four acts chosen in partnership with Battersea Arts Centre to be supported by the Oral Dramaturgies Project. This conversation took place on Skype on the 6th of April 2020 during the COVID-19 lockdown in the UK. So there are four of you, and you all met at the Norden School of Dance in Leeds. So maybe we can talk about how you individually came into that school and why, and how you discovered that you had interests in common or desire to work together.
So I came to Leeds to study Spanish and Portuguese at the university in 2009, and I spent a year doing that, but after about 3 months I realised I didn't want to do it. But I sort of wanted to stay in Leeds, and I'd done a bit of dance, but not loads. And Northern was one of the only places that did a foundation course, so I sort of decided to just give it a go. So I sort of like almost accidentally ended up doing a dance degree. I met Rachel actually in the foundation course. So after a year, I auditioned to stay in the training programme. But I'd done quite a lot of theatre as a kid, as a young person. Probably more than dance, like I'd done sort of Saturday classes and stuff in dance, but I'd done quite a lot of creative projects at the Hackney Empire in London, where I got put into it through my drama teacher, and then I ended up doing sort of dance stuff. But it was quite collaborative, the creative processes. There would be like 50 kids from the local area, and some were there to do music, and some were there to do drama, and some were there to do dance. But in the end, we ended up making a kind of mishmash show together. So that was kind of like my coming to the creative process was really, to begin with, really collaborative. And when I got to Northern, I started doing dance and kind of left behind theatre for quite some time. And I think when we started training, we were in this weird transition phase where the principal that was there when we were first there was kind of quite old school in his approach to dance, contemporary dance, particularly this sort of quite austere way of thinking of it as all about the body and very abstract. And there wasn't really any physical theatre or fusing theatre or dance very much in our first years. That, like, my first choreography in the foundation was very abstract, which now seems bizarre to me. It's so far away from what I would make now, but just because that's kind of what I thought you were supposed to make in dance.
Because of the principle.
Yeah, and because I had done some contemporary dance Saturday classes, but not that much other contemporary dance before I started training. So I didn't do it in school at all. So I hadn't really studied it, and I didn't really have a sense particularly of what it was. And so I, in a way, in the first year, I was really just replicating what I saw people do. And at that time, it was our principal who had this particular idea, but it was also contemporary dance that was being produced at that time that we were watching and taking in was very sort of abstract. It was a lot of like low lighting and beige clothes and sort of rolling around on the floor and bodily movement stuff. It was kind of, I didn't kind of read it as saying anything in particular. And I remember really clearly the first time, I can't remember whether it was in my foundation or my first year, but seeing another student in a student platform putting speaking on stage with dance. And it was the first time I'd seen it. It like something clicked in my mind where I was like, oh wow, that's so much more interesting. We can also use our voices. In our third year, Rachel and I and Rebecca and Sophia, we did a physical theatre module together with Rod Dixon from Red Ladder Theatre in Leeds. And by this point, our also our principal had sort of changed around. So Janet Smith came in it must have been in our second year. So that shifted quite dramatically. Also how people started, like, she opened out a lot how they thought about the training, and they brought in other practitioners that weren't just like pure dance movement practitioners. And it started to like open our minds a bit, I think. And in that physical theatre module, we were all in it together. And again, it was like learning to use our voices and our bodies at the same time. And I think the thing that brought us together in a way was a shared sort of disillusionment with the kind of old school nature of some contemporary dance, like getting a bit frustrated with the limitations of just being able to say things with the body, plus a kind of renewed interest in exploring work with the voice. Sophia and I, in our second year, did a sort of research, choreographic research project on just like speaking and moving, which now feels really basic, but was like totally integral to our, like, where we are now, that we were exploring in a really rudimentary way, like, how could you speak and move at the same time? What if you didn't move? What if you just spoke? And that like led on to lots of our projects of working together. And I think that's kind of the thing that brought us together as a four, was that we all were a bit bored with the contemporary dance that we saw being made and wanted to bring in different elements to make it more exciting. And to say, I think also, like, all of us had quite clear ideas about politics and themes and like our values, and we did a lot of chatting about that. And I think we felt that there was no way we could get that into the work that we wanted to make without also using our voices and tapping into all of the things at our fingertips, which we discovered was more than just body.
Yes. Let me hear Rachel's story as well, and then I'll go a bit deeper into some of that.
So I'm from rural Dorset, and my experience of any sort of performance growing up was pantomime and various working class methods of performance. And I really hadn't seen a lot at all, anything. I was quite academic, and then the school were quite persistent in me applying to Oxford or Cambridge because we were a state school, comprehensive. And there weren't many young people that did that from the area. So I got pushed down quite an academic path, and one of the biggest things for me was English literature and history. Those were my sort of key interests, but I always kept dance up alongside it because it was like my fun subject. When I went on a shadowing scheme to Cambridge for like, they used to pay for people whose family hadn't been to university to test it out before they applied. And I remember coming back and saying to my mum, oh, it's great here, but I don't want to do it. I want to dance. That's the only thing I really enjoy. And I was in a class of four people, and the other three didn't turn up. So a lot of my sessions weren't very practical. They were more sort of analysis based. And I loved that because you sort of marry that sort of language interpretation aspect of history and literature with movement. And so I sort of applied to Northern. I didn't have any concept of what dance school was going to be like. One of the reasons that I got into Northern, and something that was always said to me throughout my training, was that I was never a very technical dancer. I didn't have a lot of proper training from before, so I didn't have a really good physical grounding and technique. So I struggled a lot throughout to sort of kick bad habits. Quite early on, I realised that if I carried on this path of trying to be a technician, it was going to be more of a struggle. And so early on, I started looking at alternative things around me that I could do. I didn't really do drama. I went to drama club a couple of times when I was younger and enjoyed it, but dance was always the sort of thing. I really clearly remember being in Catesby's in second year, I think, and I was doing a duet, but we had to speak. And it was the first time I was like, oh, this can happen. And I tried making choreography in a much more traditional way before, because of the reasons that Kate already explained, because that's what we were asked to do. And I wasn't great. Like, they didn't go down very well. They were sort of rubbish. I was just like, what? I'm not quite sure this is for me. You could still try to figure out why I was there. You know, why have they chosen me? And it began to dawn on me that actually it was because I was much more of a performer. So the feedback that I'd get from teachers was like, oh, Rachel, you're often at the back doing it wrong, but I'm always watching you. So I was like, okay, so if this is the baseline, if there's something there, then how can I explore that? Alongside all that, I was building tools and improvisation. And so that was like another tool set to use. And in improvisation, sometimes obviously sounds or speech would come out. But from my second year, I started going back home and doing projects with the local arts organisation in Dorset, Activate. And the projects that got me involved in were really diverse. So I'd like done some producing work for them, and I'd been involved in a huge community project. So my world got opened up a little bit more, and I was just interested. And that has always been slightly on the opposite of what people wanted me to do.
Yeah. And earlier when you were talking, Kate, you talked about how you were all talking to each other about your beliefs, what was driving you in terms of your political orientation and so on. Was that something that was emerging out of what the course structure was, or was that just simply the zeitgeist of, you know, among the people of your generation, if you like?
Probably a bit of both. There was like a massive shift in the way that the course was structured as soon as Janet came in. It was quite a radical shift that I think like got us, encouraged us to be thinking, challenging dancers rather than just sort of passive bodies, which I felt like in my foundation course and sort of a bit of my first year, that was what all I was expected to be, was a body that could like learn someone else's movement. And suddenly she brought in a whole like new fresh cohort of teachers, of like guest teachers and new permanent teachers, who came from really different art forms and were like really good at challenging us. We had a really great guest teacher in our second year called Amy Bell, who was taught us choreography for a term. She works at a place now, she makes a lot of her own work. But I remember it being the first time, and this was midway through second year, where we were being challenged on our views in our choreography classes. We were being forced to articulate and explain why we liked something or not, beyond just being like, yeah, I like it, it's nice, which I just felt like up until that point had been the just go-to, yeah, it's nice, I like the movement, it was good. And she was really forceful with getting us to like pin down what it was we liked and didn't like in order to know what we wanted to make or not make. And I think there were quite a lot of turning points like that where we had all of these teachers that suddenly were challenging us and forcing us to broaden our perspectives, I think, outside of just this, what felt to me, particularly in foundations, this like really niche closed world that didn't feel like it had anything to do with the outside world. It was this kind of weird dance bubble. And suddenly I think what Janet did is make students see that it was like you were making work to go out into the world, and therefore you had to allow for that world to influence what you were making and have thoughts and be like a thinking dancer that made stuff that was relevant and important to you and your values and your politics. And probably another thing that brought us together is that we all have also been interested and done lots of like different things, or been interested in different kind of subjects beyond. I don't think any of the four of us were ever, in some ways, were ever just interested in doing dance. And I think we all came to it in some ways in a weird kind of accidental way, just to sort of see what happened a bit. But I almost felt like all of us could have done different things. And I think because of that, I certainly really wanted to keep hold of the perspective of there being other things going on in the world, and that that could influence the kind of work that I was making. And I've always been interested in like politics and talking about that a lot. And I think before, when my foundation course, I didn't really see how that could be brought into dance, how it had any kind of relevance to it. And I think we spent a lot of time amongst the four of us talking about the stuff that interested us, or the stuff that made us angry, or the things that made us laugh, and or the things that we thought were absurd about the world. And I think it started to dawn on us that we didn't have to keep that world separate from the creative work that we were making.
What would you say then are formative influences? Like, you've just mentioned Red Ladder and you mentioned Amy Bell. Is there a way in which you might be able to map the territory of what your practice is by reference to artists or musicians or other dancers that might have, in a way, shaped the way in which you make work?
For me, if I'm really honest, there are dancers and choreographers that I admire and who I really am interested in their work, but it's not often dancers and choreographers whose work I would definitely be like, oh, I'm so inspired by that. I didn't really see a contemporary dance work until I was 15, 16 maybe. That was Leah Anderson. I remember coming away being just completely confused, but in a really great way by it, because it obviously that she's so intricate in the details that she puts in her work, but it's very performative. They always feel like a really strong portrait, or there are, like, you know, based on portraits of people behind it. Also Hoffa Schechter and Uprising was one of the first contemporary dance pieces I saw. And sort of in opposition to that, I saw Siobhan Davies, I think it's called four quartets or two quartets or something, and I hated it. And I hated it because I couldn't understand why you'd want to watch people running in a circle. I just really felt like I was drawn to things that in a very basic way were more relevant to me, that I could see a reflection of myself in. And so of all of my sort of experiences before that had been pantomime or, you know, the occasional straight play and very much comedy. I watched lots of comedy as a young person, big with my family. And particularly my family went to see a lot of children's theatre, like I went to see Fireman Sam when I was little and things like that live, rather than actually it being something that they did as adults. But then when we were at Northern, one of the first pieces that I saw was Marie von Stockert's Trapped. And it had this amazing set where they had like a huge cube where it sort of tilted and rotated and they hung from it. But the movement to me, it felt clear, like I felt like I was being talked with rather than at. And it wasn't deliberately trying to hide something from me. I felt really sort of, I vividly understood it, but also there was room for my own interpretation. That felt like I wasn't being, you know, talked down to in a particular way. And actually Amy Bell was in that piece. And she really, like, stood out as a dancer to me. It felt like that was her on the stage, but also telling a story, being character. As the years have gone on, it's people like Pina Bausch, who within the sort of dance context have been influential. But on the other side of things, like Lucy McCormick and more theatre makers that are coming from an experimental aspect or live art aspect of things, that I felt there's just a realness or just a sense of like honesty within it that I related more to. I've never been into sort of fantasy or mystical things. I'm more interested in like the nitty-gritty of what it means to be human.
I'm telling you something. Something important, open hands. Look at how sincere I am. Tight smile. Fold hands, I'm in control. I have the answer. I am the answer. Exhale, gain their trust. I know what I'm doing because I've done it before. I'll do it again. Fold arms defensively. I know what's going on. I'm going on. Look, point. You've never had it so good. We are moving forward.
Let me be clear. Panic! In real terms, the real question is, what are we talking about here?
What about you, Kate?
I did loads of projects with Hackney Empire in London between the ages of about 13 and probably about 19. And they did a massive pantomime every year. We always used to go. And I was in it once, which was sort of weird. With, like, they sometimes ask some of the young people to, like, be, you know, gingerbread men and stuff. When I was growing up, I watched a lot more theatre and comedy than I did dance. So I didn't have really that many cultural references for it until I got to Northern. Like, initially, the dance that we were watching was quite abstract and it sort of didn't move me that much. But then, yeah, like, watching Tilted. And then I also remember watching like footage of Deviate shows in our academic studies classes, and that was the first time I'd like come into contact with Lloyd Newson and like physical theatre basically. And again, I remember it sort of blowing my mind that you could utilise dance and movement in this way to like tell something like very human and relate something really clear to people that I felt like, for me, dance often couldn't do on its own. And I actually, like, I did this project in, it must have been in the summer after my second year, called Street Stories, with it, like, East London Dance and the Royal Opera House. It was like they put young choreographers with other artistic disciplines like costume designers and musicians, and we had to like create some work, and we had workshops with people, and one of them was with Lloyd Newson, who's quite a formidable character. I've come into contact with him like a couple of times since then, and like he's an interesting character. But I remember really clearly one of the things him saying, and he has quite strict views on this, but he said, there's no way you can tell anything without speaking. It was something along the lines of like, dance in and of itself cannot tell a story, you need more. Which I wouldn't necessarily agree with actually now, but I remember at the time thinking like, yeah, I can really relate to that. I just don't get it when people just do movement. Like, it's beautiful and I can be moved by it, but I don't get what you're trying to say to me unless you tell me. It was like seeing some of those more physical theatre, the big name physical theatre ones like Tilted and Deviate and Gecko, using movement but like very much to tell a story, and also using set and also using like lots of other influences, that I felt like was a little bit where I had come from in terms of making theatre that would like to have a narrative or tell a story. And actually, I think I did, like, later on got really into Pina Bausch. I think my parents took me to see a Pina Bausch once when I was like 10 or something, and I remember like finding it hysterically funny, but like thinking it was super weird and just like, what are these people doing on stage? Like, why am I watching? Why is everyone watching? It just was mad to me. But since then, like, yeah, as I sort of got older and got like went into training, I feel like Pina Bausch has been a massive, I mean, how could she not be, but like a massive influence in terms of her. I think the difference with Pina Bausch versus some of these other more physical theatre companies like Tilted and Deviate and stuff is that it's, sometimes it's incredibly abstract. Sometimes I watch it and I have no idea what she's thinking, but I always believe, like, I always feel moved by it in a way. She's always presenting something incredibly human, whether it's through speaking or through movement or through like visuals. Even if I don't kind of, I never feel with her work that I need to get to what she's saying, because I just like fundamentally go in with the trust that she knows what she's saying and that you can interpret it how you want to. And that was like a kind of shift, I think, in my perception of viewing work, I think, in a way that I didn't, and still really don't feel with most other dance work when it's kind of more abstract. And then, yeah, like Rachel said, the sort of getting into more like live art, fringy stuff. Now I feel like I've shifted away from this, the initial like Deviate, Gecko, Tilted, that like now when I watch those, they seem almost like too slick and perfect to me. And I think there was something about watching quite a lot more like DIY stuff that was like more messy and trashy and had much more references to pop culture. And for me, like, I found it more relatable in some ways, because it like dealt with the messiness of life, and did also, I think crucially, didn't try and pretend that it was anything other than what it was, which I think shifted for us between our first and our second works, is suddenly watching all of this fringe stuff and seeing that, like, you could name that you were in a theatre and that there was an audience there and that you were watching it and they were watching it, and we all knew that we were performers and you were paying to watch us perform and we were trying to please you as performers. And there was something really freeing in, I think, like, really watching some of those shows at the Fringe, Lucy McCormick and also Ira Brand, who did a really interesting, like, drag king show. Yeah, we don't need to pretend that you're not there, the audience. We can acknowledge you, and then you can acknowledge us and be more involved in it. Now I find it very weird going to traditional plays and thinking, like, why are you pretending we're not watching you? Like, this is sort of like watching a weird film, but you're shouting very loudly.
You've mentioned the Hackney Empire a couple of times, Kate. And I just was also looking at the history of the Hackney Empire recently, specifically I was reading about the years of Roland Muldoon running it and so on, and how important it was in the 1980s and so on, of building the alternative comedy scene in London. Is that where you're from, Hackney? Is that why you went to the Hackney Empire, or was there a political reason?
So I'm from North East London, so in the borough of Haringey, which is like the next borough along from Hackney. So not that far. And I was one of the first cohorts in this thing that they called the Artist Development Programme. I think it was like number 3 when I came into it. Now it's like number 20 or something. So they were trying to recruit young people from in and around the local area. So I think maybe now it's like more Hackney based, but at that point they were going to basically into lots of state schools in and around Hackney and doing sort of workshops with young people and trying to encourage them to like audition for this project. So that's how I got involved, is that they came to my school and my drama teacher told me to go to this sort of workshop audition thing, and then they described it, and I just thought dance sounded like more fun than drama, so I did that without really thinking about it very much.
So was there a legacy of this alternative theatre scene as part of what you were doing, or was it just simply now having a completely different identity as a venue?
In some ways, Hackney Empire has like kept up a sort of alternative scene, in that like it's one of the only theatres I know in London, at least, that's like really, really rooted in the community. The kind of audiences they get are so much more diverse than any other theatres in London, because they really stay true to what, like, what people in their community would want to see in terms of their programming.
In terms of your politics as a company and the way that in which you brand yourselves as radical feminists and you are committed to this idea of shared leadership, where does that come from and how has it evolved over the years of your working together?
In some ways, I think it just started because we didn't want a boss and none of us wanted to be the boss, but we also didn't want to be bossed around. I feel like it grew quite organically in terms of just basically we all wanted to do everything. We're four quite strong characters, none of whom wanted to be told what to do by anyone else. And I think because we like started creating work collaboratively, we did quite a lot of projects together in our second and third years, and often we would make it together, or we'd do it in pairs, or the way that we created and devised was always very collaborative. It made sense to just keep working like that. Yeah, it kind of happened quite naturally because we just got asked to do things. That we got commissioned, for example, to like create a short piece for a festival at Northern about 2 months after we graduated. It got offered to us as a group. And so unless someone had really like pushed for leading that, or several of us had really stepped back from doing that, it was always going to go that way where we just all took on everything together. And it took many years, I think, of us playing around and testing methods of making that work better or worse. Like, our whole first couple of years were real experimentations in terms of like how we devise collaboratively, whilst also it not needing to be everyone doing everything all the time. I think at first we interpreted that as everyone needs to be equal in everything, and over the years managed to find tools and methods to do it more succinctly and sort of effectively whilst also keeping true to the ethos of there not being a hierarchy or not being a boss. But some people over the years we ended up with different roles, but those roles were kind of equal.
Have you found over the years though that you individually had natural affinities towards particular aspects of running the company together, that somehow the division of labour occurred kind of naturally?
Looking at it very crudely, definitely Kate and I have more of an affinity with words, and it's difficult to say you like writing a funding application, but we, you know, we're more into that. There's a sort of, you know, you can find interesting things within that about wordplay and how you put your ideas succinctly. And
yeah.
Kate and I have always been people who've been interested in like speaking and, you know, articulating our ideas if we have to present, etc. Rebecca probably sits quite more balanced on both sides of sort of a numerical and sort of written brain, and Sophia very much liked numbers and maths. In the early days when things were sort of proportioned out, they were almost done from necessity. It was like, okay, if you have a handle on this and you have a handle on that, then we'll just keep going in those lanes. After we'd done the sort of everyone doing everything, it became a bit more fluid. It became a bit more sort of in the lanes, but certain things would always be brought back to the group to be discussed. We stayed in those roles for a very long time because of some practical reasons. So, for example, I wrote the Arts Council applications after we had a producer sort of not phase out of helping us do that, and mainly because it's so complicated and it requires so much particular language to do with the Arts Council and understanding of the sector. I just kept going in that lane. And we haven't really until now, Kate and I, until we sort of went to three last year, and now Kate and I this year, had a bit more of a, starting to have conversations about how we redivide. How it looks now is sort of a current question. That sort of isn't from an admin point of view, but when it came to being in the studio, I guess understanding ourselves personally as artists and what our own skills are have been really important. But we had lots of conversations of trying to break out of those roles, you know, not just saying that, okay, so Rebecca and Sophia are really good at complex patterns in space, so they just do it. You know, trying to make sure that we don't just go, oh, it's pattern time, it's your go. But I think in the moments where it comes to something which is more equally shared as a sort of like interest and wanting to get into it, there's a lot of starting a task, not really finishing it, passing it on, passing it back, looking at it together, it sort of is a really slow process of evolving with lots of different voices come in, and then you kind of don't really know where the start point was. So, for example, in a written task, it might start from something that we've improvised in text in the studio. Then the idea gets somewhat bashed out on a keyboard, and then the laptop is passed to someone else, and the task is writing questions, and then it's passed back and changed. So those are sort of the moments where it builds. And in movement, we'll have one clear sort of start point, and then we'll do it loads of different ways, and then have discussions about, you know, what were the interesting bits, and then build again and build again and build again. So admin worked quite differently for a long time to studio, is it became more about the practicalities of getting stuff done. We don't really like admin, so we sort of haven't wanted to spend loads of time and picking how we do it and stuff, because we'd rather not do it.
So in the studio, it's more a matter of really collaborative authorship where things get passed around. In terms of decision-making then, how does decision-making work in a situation like that?
So like there's a lot of chat, there's a lot of discussions. It's like a very slow process, although I think we've got better at it over the years. When we first started in our first year and we had this programme Catapult, and we had this sort of luxury, which I think is a luxury for early career artists, to have an Arts Council bid that basically allowed us playing time to test what the hell we were doing without really needing particularly an outcome. And we did like quite a lot of playing around. And I think our first piece was made really differently to our second piece. And we made a conscious effort to try and shake up our methods.
What were the names of the first and the second piece?
The first work is called This Really Is Too Much, and the second is This Is Not a Wedding. It was sort of a coincidence that they both ended up with this. But the first one, I think, really, it took a very long time to make, because we really did do everything together. We didn't really have anyone leading any of the processes. So we, just the four of us, were like, what should we do now? Should we do this thing? Okay, maybe let's do it. And we'd stop and discuss everything all the time before we made any decisions, and so it was a very, very slow process. The second piece, we made a conscious choice, and this was through our own decision-making processes, but also through doing various mentoring. Early on, we had some mentoring with Gilly Kleinman, who kind of forced us a bit. She comes from makes very different work to us, and forced us to sort of shake up our processes quite a lot. We also did some with Kerry Nichols, who again makes very different work to us. And one of the things that we started testing in our second work, which we hadn't done in our first, was allowing for there to be days in which one of us would be leading it. And it would still be a collaborative process between the sort of director and the dancers, but we would make a conscious choice that, okay, Tuesday is Rachel's day, and Rachel's going to come prepared for the whole day to lead us in tasks. We can shift and change those tasks, and we can input in like suggesting ideas, but Rachel is making those choices and those decisions on that day. The next day would be someone else, and that person can take things from the previous day, or they can come with a totally new set of tasks. And that would be the early process. Obviously later on, when we started, it became a bit more all of us doing everything again, when we were sculpting the work together and structuring it. But in terms of the early days of research and development, we actually found that worked really well, because one of the things we found really difficult was to make this distinction between, and we couldn't really do it in the first, was making a distinction between being the choreographer, director, and being the performer, and being able to have equal weight, because we were all doing everything. It felt quite difficult to be investing loads into your performance as a performer and your devising creative skills, whilst also having a mind all the time on what the structure looked like, and what does it look like from the outside, what does this mean, should we do this, and it felt like too much to be, it was so exhausting doing both. Apart from anything else, it was kind of a way to give us a bit of a break and decide to be like, today I'm not being a performer, I'm just being a director, and I'm just having that head on, and that the performers in this day can like relinquish control of what it looks like. And it also allowed us to go with ideas for longer and say yes to things, even if where originally in our first work, I think we would stop things all the time, be like, oh, but what do you mean by this? Or where's this going? I'm not really sure about this idea. And we'd constantly be questioning and discussing things. This was a way in which we could just, even if we weren't sure about the idea, we didn't have responsibility for that day, so we could just go with it. And then sometimes interesting things came out that we might have shut down earlier had we all been in the process together.
Great. And so how did, since we've started talking about This Is Not a Wedding, Where did the impulse for this piece come about? What was the starting point? What was your intention with this piece? And then how did that change in the process of making it?
We were really interested in the idea of a wedding as a recognisable structure and ceremony. Initially, not so much about the themes of marriage or love or monogamy or weddings. And we wanted to like make this distinction between making a piece about weddings and making a piece as a wedding, if that makes sense. We were really interested in, and it's something that we kind of, in our early work, we had this like version of an auction. And there's something that we really were drawn to about this like very recognisable structure where the audience comes into something that they think that they know, and then it's broken. And it gave us a sort of almost like a map for what to be creating. But within that, felt like it would also give us lots of freedom to mess with these structures, to mess with the ceremony and the tradition. And I think initially we were more interested in the themes of tradition and ceremony and expectation and pressure than we were with weddings. And of course, in the end, because it kind of follows this structure of a wedding, it is also about weddings, and it is something that people interpret to be about weddings or about marriage, or a critique on marriage maybe people interpret it as. But I think for us it was like, it was sort of we sometimes describe it as an exploration of our existential crises. It almost felt a bit arbitrary that we chose a wedding. We wanted to pick a very recognisable structure that everyone would have some relationship to. And a wedding seemed like a relevant one. But in a way, it's not a coincidence that it was a wedding, given that we'd all turned 30 or been about to turn 30. And it was this like thing, this mega rite of passage that women in particular are expected to be aiming towards their whole lives. And that it coincided with that point in our life, I think, meant that all of those themes, of those things that we were thinking and feeling and talking to each other about, also came into the piece naturally. It became this sort of piece about time and mortality a bit, and like the pressure and expectation of having to achieve success in a very particular type of way, particularly given that we have chosen career paths that are not the traditional career path and that don't lead you to the successful rites of passage that other people do in their lives that they can tick off nicely. And, you know, it definitely does change things turning 30 and being like, am I going to spend the next 10 years of my life not knowing what my work is going to look like in 2 months? And so in a way, like all of those themes became really relevant. And I think it was no longer a coincidence that we'd chosen a wedding. It became very relevant.
What comes first in a piece like this? I was watching it earlier. I was thinking, actually, probably a very good encapsulation of the piece as a whole is that number where you do Too Good to Be True, and it kind of switches between speech and music. And the whole piece kind of does that as well. It sort of switches between the dance numbers and the spoken interactions with the audience. And so what came first, you know, in the process of making? It's like, you know, asking a musician what comes first, the lyrics or the music?
I think, honestly, the dresses came quite early on, and the sort of physicalization of struggle in the dresses. But to sort of go a little bit back to what Kate was saying, there's sort of two other things that were in our minds. One is negotiation, and we talked about very early on, is this going to be a piece about collective values? It was sort of there. And the beginning negotiation that you see in the first sort of quarter of the piece, we talked about whether we kept that in or not, or whether it was going down a different avenue. But actually, the negotiation with the audience is this big thing. And I think that was probably something that came out of us addressing our processes in the studio and working in a different way, because that was also on our minds, how are we going to work differently? But also space. So we've worked in site specific ways before, and sometimes we think quite sort of, like as Kate said, the recognisable structure of something, or like the connotations of something. Space can obviously add something very literal to that. But the idea that we're breaking the fourth wall with the audience, they are part of the performance space. That was something fairly early, because we had to perform it. The first R&D period that we had, there had to be a performance as part of Bolton Octagon's reveal festival, and it was in a church. So obviously the practicalities of space in a church were that we were going to use the aisle, and it felt more like a more cohesive thing. And I think probably the first 20 minutes of the piece at least are the same in the final version, and that was sort of almost set very early on in relation to some of those factors.
When you say negotiation with the audience, I just want to kind of delve a bit deeper in that. Well, what exactly is being negotiated with the audience?
It's funny because the negotiation in some ways, like, it came throughout the process, and then we added it, the initial what we call the negotiation, which is the kind of like chat with the audience at the beginning, we added probably about 2 days before we first performed the entire thing. It was a sort of like meta theme of weddings are this thing that you're sort of doing a bit for yourself, but often like for other people. And it is a performance. There's something so performative about a wedding, that everyone else is there and people are expecting it to be a certain way, and people have their ideas about how it should be. And it suddenly felt so relevant to us as performers that's always what we're doing, is negotiating with the audience and trying to please them. Like, no matter how much you try and divorce yourself from that as a creator and an artist, that you don't care about the audience and what they think. Of course you do, because they're the ones that ultimately pay your bills. You know, it doesn't exist without, live performance doesn't really exist without an audience, and therefore there's always this feeling kind of in the back of your mind that you want them to like it, or you want them to feel something or engage with it in a certain way. And it suddenly felt really relevant to us in the making process that we would include that as part of the piece, that it would be something where we both wanted it to be this kind of thing that the audience came into and had no choice about. So it was just that they were coming into this situation that we as performers were assuming that they knew and were acting accordingly, and also something where we needed their constant feedback and needed to be hearing from them and asking their advice and trying to constantly please them and keep things sort of like nice for them. Yeah. And so we have this sort of weird mixture between asking them questions but not really waiting for their responses, or just ignoring them, and we wanted to have these two things existing at once, where actually the audience are kind of involved and they're asked to be involved, but we don't really care what they say. And there also is this sort of process throughout where it's us as like performers / brides / like women in this piece, like letting go of needing to please them. Everything is falling apart at the beginning and we're trying to hold it together. And by the end, we've sort of let go of any kind of semblance of control over the situation and therefore any desire to make it better for the audience.
So what are the strands? So there are the dresses, there is this negotiation with the audience, or rather this acknowledgement of the shared time and space. And then, of course, there is the dancing, which is what you as a dance company are expected to be doing. And then there are decisions around how you use voice, which are not necessarily straightforward. There is the lip syncing, there is the different kinds of use of the microphone in the show and the non-uses of the microphone. How did all of that get knitted together? Where did the lip syncing come from?
At the beginning, we would layer more and more tasks on top of more and more tasks. Sometimes we'd have a long improvisation where we were putting post-it notes on someone so that they just had to suddenly do an existential voguing sermon on top of a box while they tried to eat a packet of crisps. It was like, you know, the impossible things that we were adding on top and on top of each other. And I think the lip syncing, just like, we kept bringing back as something that was quite aesthetically pleasing. And this interesting thing, I think, of like having a voice and not having a voice, of being seen to look like you're saying something, but actually someone else is speaking for you. And those are themes also that ended up being woven into it almost like unconsciously, and then kind of bringing it forward more consciously. Like with the, for example, with the Fred speech, this idea that it's like you're expected to say something, but you're not really actually expected to say something, we'll just say it for you. I feel like that became a bit of a present theme throughout, where we were sort of speaking but not speaking, or someone else was taking our voice, or we were taking someone else's, and that also felt relevant.
So, I don't want to talk about this. I'm not going to talk about this. I'm not going to talk about how it makes me feel. I'm not going to talk about anything that makes us feel uncomfortable. I'm not going to talk about feeling old, feeling new, feeling borrowed, feeling... I'm not going to talk about what's really going on here. I'm not talk about the fact that we're all running out of time. I'm not going to talk about the fact of growing up, growing stale, reaching stalemate, checkmate, checking our mates, losing our mates, losing our faith, losing our minds, minding our own bloody business. I'm not going to talk about death.
Oh, Tim, before we go, is what we perceive a reality or just a construct of our minds?
I think there's also a really big thing in the work about the backstage and the front stage, which relates to sort of the use of the mic and how you can hear us. We talked a lot about which bits the audience needed to hear and which they didn't. He probably noticed that a lot of the text in our work doesn't quite make sense, or it's not designed to be like particularly... It doesn't give the audience the exact thing that's what's going on. It's a sense or a feeling. And so sometimes you can see us in the back and hear us a little bit talking to each other. And the talking does make sense within the piece, but the idea more is that there's something going on backstage. You can see the gradual sort of build-up of tension in the performers by exposing how DIY this whole thing is. And then... the sort of ludicrousness of sometimes using the mic to address everybody and as a pretense that the mic is somehow more official and in charge and in control and clearer, which sometimes it just isn't clearer. And I think we're really, we joke a lot about using our lighting very differently to a lot of contemporary dancers because we're always going to our technicians, more on the face, more on the face. And I think we're quite interested in this presentational aspect of like, I'm here in front of you, for some weird reason you've paid to come and see me, therefore I've got the mic, so I'm going to tell you things, but as Kate said, we're sort of also wanting to please. And I think a lot of the use of the sound, we've been interested in our pieces a lot in sort of the external force that cuts you off, whether that be because the mic is dead, or the music's too loud, or maybe the music's too low. You know, there's this sort of sense that it provides an external force that we have to adhere to, and there's a lot of pretense in what we decide to use and what we don't, down to what Kate's saying about holding the mic to someone but then taking it away so you can half hear what the audience say. That was a big thing to talk about and has actually played a part in our previous work as well, the idea of taking away the sound. It goes back again to the sort of ludicrousness of pretending that people aren't there and are there, and acknowledging that we're in a theatre but we're pretending that something else is going on. I think we like to play that in the sound. And also because you can hear, you know, we refer to each other with our real names or tell each other off, or, you know, there's somewhat of a reality to be seen in that as well, how we speak to each other versus how we speak to the audience.
And what about the chorus number, like when suddenly all the other dancers come on, where do they come from?
That is a section of the piece that changes depending on where we're touring it to. It can be delivered as a sort of outreach workshop to like local communities or to dancers or whoever ends up being there, as a way of like getting them involved in the piece. But it was something that particular performance was at Northern. So we used Northern dancers, and it was something we thought of again, like kind of towards the end, where we had this like backing singer dying is what we call the section. We have this like repetitive music that comes on where we kind of do this bizarre, like slightly boring backing singer dance, which is this like performative element of almost like everything. As Rachel said, we have this constant idea of like things are kind of falling apart in the background, but it's almost like we as performers don't know that you can see that, so the front of the stage and the microphone and all these like this presentational aspect is what we want you to see versus what's actually happening, which is everything's kind of falling apart. This thing of like, I think particularly relevant now that everyone has this like presentation of their life versus the life that they're actually living, and we're able to like curate how people see that to a certain extent, and what would happen if we could actually see what was going on, in order to all of the things that went into making that photo look so perfect, or that sort of short image. And so we wanted to like show that on stage, and I think this kind of repetition of this perfect backing singer dance that just repeats and repeats and repeats is this, like, bringing it back to this performative element. As long as we do this, they'll be very impressed by this dance that we do, and it'll be so neat and so perfect that they'll just forget everything that just happened, which is that everything's falling apart. There's, like, a crucial moment in the piece where it's like those two worlds start to meet, and I think that's kind of the moment we can't hide it anymore. There's the presentational, and yet we're just falling apart, like we're dying. It's something that we really liked using a lot in our early pieces, having, like, plants in the audience, people that you think are audience members that aren't actually audience members, they're going to come on stage. We really liked the idea that suddenly this party would be filled with guests that were all part of the audience and somehow are being brought on stage, and are also demonstrating this just, like, desperation with the situation by dying really dramatically and then just carrying on as if nothing's happened. It's like the inner and the outer world combining, this sort of, like, we cannot possibly hide anymore what's going on, but we're going to keep trying and keep just laboriously, repetitively doing this dance, even though people around us are dramatically dying and then getting up again. So we thought that, yeah, we sort of aesthetically really wanted to have that with a load of people. But when we've toured it, sometimes we just do that section with four of us, and sometimes, depending on who is in the community, we sometimes do workshops. We did it in Dorset, for example, with an older performance group. They were all sort of, I don't know, between 50 and 60, 70, yeah. So it was, like, very different aesthetic. And there's a simplified version with people that aren't dancers. And so it's also, like, a way of, like, really getting people directly involved in the performance.
Great, that's fantastic. I could probably ask more, but I'm aware of the time. And also, I don't know whether we can also touch on the current project before we finish. Remind us, what was your intention with the new piece then?
One of the big things that we've been talking about, and sort of carrying on from in This Is Not a Wedding, is the apocalyptic sermon, we call it, at the end, where it's like almost a preacher telling you how to live your life and why don't you just party. And also because on our mind had been, you know, we talked a lot about climate change and whether time was running out, and this suddenly mounting pressure with the end of the world coming, and the idea that might not be too long, that climate disaster changes the way that we have an outlook on life. Because I sort of thought, you know, both of our pieces have been in response to our thoughts and feelings about the world and the current situation, and that was sort of a wide enough frame. I think definitely now it's very relevant to us, and as Kate said, we'll have had lots of personal experience of the feeling like it's the end of the world. But I think there were some big shifts that we wanted to sort of acknowledge within this work.
Yeah, I think just that in terms of the structure of it being site-specific and more immersive, it felt like a natural progression from where we were at with This Is Not a Wedding, where it was kind of like half in, half out audience participation immersion. It was a piece made for theatres. So I think particularly in making something about the end of the world, it felt like really important to take that out of these, like, in some ways quite restrictive traditional structures of a theatre that only specific people come into and feel quite closed in a way, to take that out into a different kind of space somehow felt really important, particularly with the themes of this work being something that's going to and is now currently affecting everyone. Like, the end of the world as we know it is, like, I think when we wrote that pitch we didn't think it was going to happen quite so soon.
So let's say this, the end of the world slows down, you know, that we actually re-emerge from this crisis and things kind of get back on track in whatever way. What will happen in the week that we spend together, you know, in terms of developing the idea?
One of the first sort of tasks that we did in the early days of This Is Not a Wedding was basically providing space for everyone to free speak on the ideas. So every day people would record 5 minutes of them talking about weddings and just let them meander. Then we would go back, listen to everyone's, and we would just, again, free write things like coming together and apart, which of course actually is a big thing in the piece, the coming together and apart. So I would imagine that we start with things quite as free as that, because I think we work a lot on the notion that if it's going on in our minds, it comes out in our bodies. I think a lot of the work as well, as Kate said, it's about these interpersonal relationships as well. Like, our work often looks at sort of like the absurdities of hierarchies or like the structures imposed upon us and the fact that this might change that. And so I'd be interested in how people play together, how they meet, how they come together, how they express something which can be quite your own mortality is not something you necessarily discuss with strangers. How can we create lightness about that? Or what are the ways that people reach out to each other and discuss it or physicalise it? Probably a lot of that week will be to do with meetings and coming togethers and figuring out what it is to be able to share some of those quite difficult conversations and be in the space physically and support each other, and whether there are frictions that maybe emerge between people, you know, senses of resolve and no, I'm not gonna deal with it, I'm gonna carry on doing this. And how does that sit next to someone who wants to sit in it? You know, that's an interesting tension if two people are wanting to deal with something differently in a space. So I guess there might be a little bit of that.
Excellent. Okay, well I hope it goes really well and that we are all back on track quite soon.
You've been listening to Lend Me Your Ears, presented by Duška Radosavljević, curated by Flora Petrolo, and produced by Tim Bano. The Lend Me Your Ears podcast is part of Oral Dramaturgies, an AHRC leadership fellowship held by Duška Radosavljević at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama.